Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Eric Pica, President of Friends of the Earth, who takes a critical look at the U.S. State Department's environmental impact statement on the Keystone XL pipeline, as environmental activists mobilize pressure on President Obama to reject the pipeline project. Alexandra Harrington, a Yale University researcher, and Leslie Aponte, the mother of a young man convicted of felony murder when he was 17 years old, who discussed proposed legislation in Connecticut to provide juvenile offenders serving lengthy sentences a second chance. And a 1994 interview with the late singer, songwriter, and activist Pete Seeger, where the much-loved social justice champion talked about music, democracy, and threats to the environment. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A year ago, France sent 5,000 soldiers to intervene in Mali to stop Islamic rebels from taking over the West African country. In a matter of weeks, the intervention scattered the rebel force from northern Mali, which fled across northern Africa. Since Algeria declared independence in 1962, France has repeatedly intervened militarily in its former African colonies in what it says is an effort to preserve stability and access to markets. In December, France sent 1,600 troops to the troubled Central African Republic, which many observers fear is quickly moving towards civil war between the Christian majority and rebels of the Muslim minority. French President François Hollande called for broad European involvement in the region to help address the growing humanitarian crisis. Germany quickly agreed to provide military assistance for peacekeepers in war-torn African countries. Even with the successful French intervention in Mali, the West African nation faces deep-rooted poverty, corruption, and ethnic rivalries. Critics of the French intervention in Africa say the military action is driven more by economic interests than politics or ideology. Stacey Jorgensen survived pancreatic cancer but still had $43,000 in student loans to pay off. With the mounting medical bills, Jorgensen filed for bankruptcy citing undue hardship. But the bankruptcy filing was blocked by the Educational Credit Management Corporation, the agency set up in the early 1990s to prevent student debtors from going into bankruptcy court to wipe out their debts. The aggressive collection tactics used by Educational Credit are now coming under scrutiny as the total student loan debt has surpassed $1 trillion. Educational Credit's tactics have been denounced in recent months by consumer advocates and bankruptcy lawyers. In 2012, a panel of bankruptcy appeals judges blasted Educational Credit, contracted by the U.S. Department of Education, for what it characterized as a waste of judicial resources whose collection tactics constituted an abuse of the bankruptcy process and defiance of the court's authority. Emory Law professor Raphael Pardo, who has analyzed hundreds of adversary proceedings involving the nonprofit, said, "We should be outraged when a student loan creditor like Educational Credit can use bulldog tactics to scare away someone who has a legitimate claim for relief." Community organizer George Gale learned the craft of agitation as a volunteer in a soup kitchen in Bloomington, Indiana. He started to ask regulars at the soup kitchen about the root causes of poverty. Gale soon moved to Chicago to work with organizer Shel Trapp, a disciple of Saul Alinsky, the father of modern community organizing and author of Rules for Radicals. Trapp taught the Chicago School of Organizing, which called for pragmatism in building power for poor people with a focus on common issues rather than rigid ideology. His goal was to create powerful organizations for poor people, not on mobilizing social movements. Trapp used this approach to build National People's Action in the early 1970s, a network of community groups that exposed redlining of poor communities and helped pass the 1977 Community Reinvestment Act. For several years, Gale left National People's Action to work on immigrant rights, which had a different formula for educating activists. Gale returned to NPA in 2008, becoming the group's executive director. He applied a new strategy to community organizing, which led to dramatic growth in the NPA network and new alliances with unions and progressive organizations. Now, NPA has embraced a vision of change focused on building a new American economy for working people that includes pushing for public control over financial services, organizing cooperatives, and other economic alternatives, as well as taking the first steps toward entering electoral politics. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
The U.S. State Department released its long-awaited environmental impact statement on the controversial Keystone XL pipeline project that would move tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, to Texas Gulf refineries. The report indicated that approval or denial of the pipeline will make no difference in the rate of extraction of tar sands oil, given that producers can transport the oil via rail tankers if the Keystone project is rejected. However, the report acknowledged that extracting or burning tar sands oil produces about 17% more greenhouse gas emissions linked to climate change than traditional oil. Environmental groups dispute many of the conclusions of the report and have called into question its credibility, given that documents they obtained revealed that some consultants for the company that produced the draft impact statement had previously been employed by TransCanada, the company that wants to build the pipeline. If an inspector general's investigation confirms conflicts of interest in the environmental report, the State Department may have to undertake a new environmental review. Advocates for the project maintain that the pipeline will create jobs and reduce U.S. dependency on oil from the volatile Middle East and Venezuela. With the release of the report, Secretary of State John Kerry must now make a recommendation on the pipeline to President Obama. Mr. Obama, who will make the final decision, has said he'll only authorize the project if it's determined that the pipeline won't worsen carbon pollution. Your reporter spoke with Eric Pica, president of Friends of the Earth, who takes a critical look at the environmental impact statement on the Keystone XL project and the steps environmental activists are taking to mobilize pressure on President Obama to reject the tar sands pipeline.
So the State Department released the final environmental impact statement. And what should be known about the statement is that, you know, Friends of the Earth has been tracking the contractor who drafted this report for the State Department. The contractor name is Environmental Resource Management, or ERM. And what we found is that ERM has a series of links to the oil industry. And they also neglected to disclose those connections, both financial and organizational, to the State Department. And this disclosure was required underneath conflict of interest disclosure forms that they had to fill. And so Friends of the Earth and some of our partner groups have been really hammering the fact that, you know, ERM lied in some basic documents to the State Department disclosing their conflicts. And so how can we trust much of the data that's in this report because of the ties to not only the oil industry, such as the American Petroleum Institute, but also to companies that will financially benefit from the Keystone XL pipeline, such as TransCanada. We found that twice ERM worked with TransCanada over the last 3 years, which was supposed to be disclosed. So once you remove the kind of the contractor conflict of interest, and then you get into the nuts and bolts of the report itself, the State Department really forgets about one alternative when they do the environmental impact statement, and that is just keeping the oil, the tar sands oil, in the ground. There's a presumption in this report, which we think is false, that the tar sands oil will get mined and drilled somehow, somewhere. And the facts just don't bear that out right now. Right now, the entire tar sands industry is banking on the fact that President Obama will approve the Keystone XL pipeline, which will be the lead infrastructure piece, the lead pipeline that will extract the tar sands from Alberta.
President Obama claimed during the summer that he would only approve the TransCanada pipeline if it was found that the project would not worsen carbon pollution. And this State Department report in the minds of many supporters of the pipeline project, say this gives him the green light to go forward. How would you refute that particular litmus test, if you would, the fact that this pipeline by itself won't impact carbon emissions?
Right. Well, in the State Department analysis, actually there's a scenario in there that indicates that greenhouse gas carbon pollution will increase with the Keystone XL pipeline. And, you know, the State Department estimate is that it'll increase by between 1.5 million metric tons to 27 million metric tons a year. And that high number actually is equivalent to, I believe, 5.4, 5.7 million new cars driving on the roads today. So there is a significant carbon impact, but it's all based on the assumptions that you make. And, you know, the State Department's environmental impact statement, the preponderance of the assumptions are, you know, the tar sands oils are going to get mined. They're going to get mined regardless. Therefore, we don't need to count the greenhouse gas emissions. But there are a couple of assumptions in that report that actually do make the case that carbon pollution is going to increase from the extraction of these tar sands.
Eric Pica, what is your group and other environmental organizations and activist groups doing now to mobilize opposition to the Keystone Pipeline to influence President Obama's decision?
Some of our sister groups, led by Crudo Mobile Rainforest Action, have asked volunteers to volunteer to commit acts of civil disobedience. And there are over 70,000 people around the country have volunteered when the time comes, if the time comes, to do civil disobedience. And then, you know, there's ongoing activism. We're going to have this 30-day public comment period, which we plan to turn out tens of thousands of people to. And then, you know, there's just the ongoing work of debunking the myths that are in the State Department's environmental impact statement, continuing to show that the contractor ERM has conflicts of interest and that this process has been tainted, as well as, you know, try to use whatever political leverage we have with Secretary Kerry and ultimately President Obama to demonstrate that he's got support. They've got support from deep support from the environmental community if they oppose this pipeline.
That was Eric Pica, president of Friends of the Earth. For more information on groups organizing opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When the Connecticut legislature convenes this week, a bill will be introduced to provide a second look at lengthy prison sentences imposed on those who were juveniles when they committed crimes. A joint study by the law clinics at Quinnipiac and Yale Universities revealed significant racial disparities. The study found that among 275 male inmates, 60% of those serving more than 10 years are African American, 69% of those serving 50 years or more are African American, and 100% of those serving life without parole sentences for individuals are also African American. The report reiterates what is now understood in the scientific community, that human brains are not fully developed until the mid-20s, making juvenile offenders less culpable for their actions and also more capable of rehabilitation. The proposed legislation is not a get-out-of-jail-free card, but rather would provide inmates serving long sentences an opportunity to apply for sentence reductions based on individual evaluations. The bill was endorsed unanimously by the Connecticut Sentencing Commission, whose members include a judge, a victim's advocate, and a prosecutor, among other experts. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke about the proposed measure with Alexandra Harrington, a third-year law student at Yale University who conducted research on juvenile offenders, and Leslie Aponte, the mother of a young man convicted of felony murder, which took place when he was 17 years old. Her son, Nicholas, is now serving the 18th year of a 38-year sentence. He was not the shooter in the crime, but was involved in a robbery in which the victim was killed.
So our clinic for 2 years has been working on this issue, and it started with a report where we analyzed Connecticut's practice of sentencing teenagers, really, in adult court to these lengthy sentences. It grew into a project where we've talked to several individuals who are currently serving sentences for crimes committed as children, and has also involved some talking with the legislature and testimony before the Judiciary Committee. So there are two parts to the proposal. The first part says that life without parole can no longer be a mandatory sentence in Connecticut, and that's pretty fundamental. The Supreme Court has said that mandatory life without parole sentences for teenagers are unconstitutional, so that has to be changed. It also says that when judges are sentencing these teenagers in adult court and considering these long sentences, they have to take into account factors like their age, their maturity, their capacity for change, that those have to be a part of the sentencing consideration. Then the second part provides for what's called a second look review, basically a parole-like proceeding for people who have sentences of more than 10 years for crimes committed as children. It would provide for a parole review at 60% of the sentence or 12 years, whichever is longer. Anyone who has a sentence of more than 50 years would get this parole review after serving 30 years. And currently, most of these people either have no chance at parole or they only have a chance at parole after serving 85% of their sentence.
So you're referring to them as children, which I guess technically they are. A lot of these young people are like 17 when they commit this crime or are convicted of committing the crime.
14.
Yeah, one was 14. But I'm imagining that, say, a 16, 17-year-old teenager who's involved in some kind of a violent crime would not be considered by the victims of that crime or society in general as children. So how do you address that, and how do you sort of convince people that they are children and that their brains have not fully developed and all that?
Sure. I mean, like you just suggested, there is a lot of recent brain science that suggests that people's brains don't fully develop until they're 26. Obviously, in the popular conception, if we see someone who's 16, we think they know right from wrong. And the purpose of these bills is not to diminish the seriousness of the crime, but rather to express through the legislature the reality that people can change, and that when you're 16 years old, your character's not formed. You still have the capacity for rehabilitation. And part of what has been written into these proposals is actually an opportunity for the victims to speak before the parole board when these people are eligible for parole. And I guess the final thing I would emphasize is just that this proposal does not give everyone a blanket opportunity for release. It just gives them a chance to show that they've changed and that they can contribute and be successful members of society.
If you're saying that this is nothing more than what the Supreme Court's already ruled, doesn't Connecticut have to do it? I mean, why do you need legislation?
So if it goes through the courts, we kind of end up with this murky system where people are going back for resentencing hearings, where there's not a systematic way, for example, for victims to be notified, or there's not a systematic way for the judges to know what am I supposed to be considering when I'm resentencing these people. Without the legislation telling the courts what's supposed to happen, it kind of becomes a mess as to what the next steps are. And there have been some cases that have gone back for resentencing, and a lot of the judges have expressed reluctance to act on these cases until the legislature acts.
Next is Leslie Aponte, the mother of a youth convicted of felony murder that took place when he was 17. Her son, Nicholas, is in the 18th year of a 38-year sentence.
He's never allowed the walls of the prison to consume him, so he's always looked beyond the walls with hope that he'd come home one day. He continued to educate himself. He's gone through a lot of depressions, a lot of things, of course, in prison. But he's always, I mean, he's been my supporter, in all honesty, through all this. He loves doing what he does. I mean, you can work anywhere. You can work in the gym. You can work in the kitchen. He loves doing what he's doing. He feels like that's his calling. He's met a lot of wonderful people, even prisoners. He's, you know, let them die with dignity. He always tells them, I'm here because I care. Sometimes that's the last face they see is my son's.
Do you understand the legislation? Tell me what you know about it, why you support it.
I support it because of all the studies that were done. We obviously know that the brain isn't fully developed at a young age. And this bill, it will give my son the opportunity to come home sooner than the 38-year sentence. Even if it's about 60% of his sentence, he certainly has done that. So, you know, I just believe that he's one of the ones that would, you know, that I would love for them to consider.
That was Leslie Aponte, mother of a prisoner incarcerated for a crime committed when he was a juvenile, and Alexandra Harrington, a Yale law student who conducted research on Connecticut juvenile offenders. Find links to research and commentary on Connecticut's Second Look legislation by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
So long, been good to know you. So long,
been good to know you. So long, been good to know you. This dusty old dust is getting my home, and I got to be drifting along.
Pete Seeger, one of the world's best-known and most loved folk singers, songwriters, and social activists, died on January 27th at the age of 94. During more than six decades of agitation through his music, Seeger struggled for peace and social justice, not as something he pursued in his spare time, but as a full-time vocation. Best known for his songs Where Have All the Flowers Gone, If I Had a Hammer, and Turn, 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 Pete was actively engaged in the civil rights, pro-union, anti-Vietnam War, environmental, and Central American peace movements. For his progressive activism, the singer was blacklisted and brought before the House Un-American Activities Committee during the height of the anti-communist McCarthy era in August 1955. Seeger picked up the banjo while attending a Connecticut prep school. Later, after flunking out of Harvard University, becoming radicalized, and making an aborted stab at journalism, Seeger committed himself to social change through folk music, forming the Almanac Singers featuring Woody Guthrie in 1941. But it was the Weavers, a group that came together just as Seeger was thinking about giving up performing, that made him a star. Your reporter spoke with Pete Seeger at the annual People's Music Network retreat in Pine Bush, New York, on June 5, 1994. Under a tree with birds chirping on that sunny spring day, Seeger, then age 74, talked about music, democracy, capitalism, threats to the environment, the future of the human race, and his Clearwater Project. Here now is an excerpt of that interview.
Unions are in decline mainly because the old style ways of working have not been changed. There's going to be a whole brand new generation of union leaders coming along who are going to realize that unions must become international. Business is international. Unions are going to have to become international. And they'll be multilingual. They'll have big arguments, but workers in the same industry in Africa and Asia and Latin America, as well as Europe and North America, will all be putting their heads together saying, now look, the only way we'll handle this problem is if we all cooperate closely.
During the 60s, people were focusing on issues like Vietnam and the civil rights movement. What are people focusing on now? Is there any couple of topics that seem to crop up at this festival for the last couple of years?
People often ask me that question. People say, what do you think is the most important thing to work on? I tell them, I think whatever is nearest to you. There was a biologist who said, René Dubos coined the phrase, think globally, act locally. He says, how can you save the world if you can't save the corner of it where you live? Don't travel to some glamorous place far off and think you're going to solve the world's problems there. Solve it right where you are. Don't run away from them. Running away from them is something which human beings have done for thousands of years. Poor people ran away from Europe to try and get away from the kings and the dukes that controlled Europe. And black people left Mississippi to try and find a better place to live up north. Now many of them are going back. They find that there's things they can do in the South they can't do in Harlem or in Detroit or Chicago. My guess is people will gradually realize that it's one crisis the human race faces. It's a crisis of poverty amidst plenty. There's no reason anybody in the world need be hungry or go without a home. And education, with one small fraction of the money spent and wasted on silly things like guns and bombs and fashion design and so on, there could be a college education for everybody in the world. We've got the technology to do it. You don't need a big campus to have a university. All you need is some computers and people who know how to teach others how to use them. So we got a crisis of poverty amidst plenty. The rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And the jobs are running away to Mexico. We've got a crisis of pollution, everybody knows, of chemists that are having a lot of fun discovering new chemicals and not paying any attention to which ones might be dangerous. And now most of us are walking around with small amounts of dioxin on our bodies. We breathe it in. We drink it in. It gets in the food. And the cancer rate is steadily going up, 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 up. And then when somebody close to you dies, you say, what could I have done to stop it? Here's what you can do. Start reading right now about the environmental crisis and realize that it's going to kill you and your children if you don't solve it. So it's a crisis of pollution. Of course, it's hard to know who to believe because the scientists get bought off. They're normal human beings, and you offer them a good salary, they'll work for a businessman and come out with the numbers which think they can prove something. Figures don't lie, but liars can figure. It's a crisis, I would say, of alienation. The machine has made people feel like they're not so important anymore. The machine says to us, I can do it cheaper. I can do it better. My whole life has been spent trying to persuade people to do things themselves, not just as musicians, to make music themselves, but also to make things. I built my own house. I'm a do-it-yourself carpenter. My wife and I didn't have much money, but we raised a family in a house that cost $900. I went to a school where I learned how to use an axe up there in Connecticut near Hartford. I had 3,000 acres, and I got in the woods crew as a teenager. So I built a log cabin. It's a funny house. In a windy day, it's hard to keep it warm sometimes in winter, but we lived in it. I'm convinced that if there's a human race here 100 years from now, and there may not be, you know, we don't straighten up and learn a few things. Ancient lessons taught us thousands of years ago, but people still don't listen to or don't act on them. If we don't learn them, there won't be a human race. But if people keep plugging, it doesn't take a big organization. It just takes a few people putting their heads together and say, let's do something. You can't depend on old folks like me to teach kids. We can help. But it's going to be the young folks that'll do the teaching. Of course, consider this. Every society has the task of facing an onrushing horde of barbarians, their own children.
That was the late singer, songwriter, and activist Pete Seeger in an interview conducted on June 5, 1994. For a link to the full 30-minute interview and partial transcript, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.